Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
Hit your money goals without switching platforms. Download SoFi's all-in-one super app for industry-leading APY, great loan rates, and stock trading. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank, NA, NMLS, 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. All right, welcome to the Monday edition of the On the Tape podcast. I am Dan Nathan. I am joined by Liz Young. That would be EY from SoFi. Liz, welcome.
What's up? Monday.
You know, listen, we're not even going to do this April Fool's thing. We're not going to get fooled again here. I'm sure like you're a little bit of a prankster in general. It's not something that Guy Adami and I really subscribe to. And Amanda already gave us the heads up. She's like, none of it today on the Risk Rotation Media podcast.
Well, I was hoping it would be a Marquette Monday, but it's not. It was a dumpster fire. Total dumpster fire.
It's okay. And I am, if UConn were to win, no matter who they beat, I am going to be the winner of my pool. How about that?
Why? Because you took all the one seeds. What if NC State as an 11 seed takes the whole thing? I hope they do, frankly.
I don't care. I'd like to see them beat Purdue and then play UConn and like have UConn win. So that's it. Okay. Liz, we got a lot to do today. We got a lot going on this week. Carter Braxton Worth is going to be Guy in with myself on Market Call a couple times this week. You are going to be rejoining Guy and me on the Wednesday Market Call. Danny Moses is back on the Friday drop of the On the Tape podcast. So we got a lot going on there. Please follow us at the Risk Reversal Media YouTube page. All right, Liz, let's do it. You know, we didn't have a trading day on Friday, but there was plenty of news over the week. We had some inflation data. We had Fed Chair Powell speaking about the strength of the economy. We had some manufacturing data out of China, pulling it out of contraction, like one of the highest readings that we've seen for a PMI, I think, in a year. We have some folks coming around to the fact that the Mag 7 is over. It's just the Fantastic Four. Our good friend Peter Bukvar is talking about euphoria and how it's here in the markets, and a whole host of other stuff. What gold's telling us at new all-time highs. No real earnings, plenty of data. Where do you want to start? Let's start with Friday with the PCE data that got the futures kind of, you know, bumping a little bit. And then Fed Chair Powell, here's the comment from him. The economy is strong. We see very strong growth. There's no reason to think the economy is in recession or is at the edge of one. That means that we don't need to be in a hurry to cut. So to me, that sounds bullish economy, bearish on rate cuts, but the stock market doesn't care. It's keying off the economy stuff. But Liz, I thought the stock market was keying off those six rate cuts that were originally priced in December, and then three, and then pretty soon it's going to be nothing.
If nothing else changes, I think this June cut is going to get priced out pretty quickly. And if we get hot jobs data this week, it's going to get priced out pretty quickly. And frankly, it should if that's the case. Because if the economy is as strong as everybody says it is and as Powell believes it is, there is no reason for them to cut rates. And in fact, if they do cut rates, it just fuels an overheating. So what I think is really interesting today, I'm looking at the 10-year Treasury right now. It's at about 4.25, up from 4.19-ish or so. So already up 6 basis points. We've talked about this a lot, both on OTT and on Market Call, this higher for longer idea, the 10-year in particular, staying higher for longer, and now it's sort of inching back upward again, yet stocks continue to go up as well. So if you look at the 10-year rising and you see gold really taking off again this morning, those two things, and I talk about this all the time, that's a relationship problem. Those two things don't make sense. Gold doesn't pay any interest, so really gold should only rally if rates are coming down and you're not getting the dividends or you're not getting the yield that you would normally get. Yet gold continues to rise. So what that tells me is that there are some investors out there still concerned about a currency crisis and not totally sold on the idea that the Fed cutting rates is just an altogether good thing and inflation is taken care of. And I think that PCE data on Friday, although explained away by most, was another indication that inflation is not taken care of.
All right. What about the long and variable lags of interest rate policy, right? So that whole notion of higher for longer. And listen, let's be clear here, okay? Like, you know, the 10-year yield at 4.23 or so is, you know, Carter Braxton Worth had a great note out on Worth Charting showing that we're in the exact same spot that we were a year ago. And the last time the stock market got a little funky to the downside is when the 10-year had that huge push from 4% to 5%. And again, you know, a weird relationship at the time because the direction of inflation was clearly upper left, bottom right, the way it has been for, you know, a year and a half now at this point. But for some reason, the narrative shifted, right? And I remember we had Rick Santelli come on Fast Money one night in the fall talking about how he could see yields in the years to come above 10%, maybe as high as 13%. And so it's interesting. That marked the top. And I'm not, Rick Santelli, I think, is a great market prognostic, but it's just interesting. That was the narrative. Now the narrative is that, okay, you price out those rate cuts, but the economy is strong enough. And if you look at whether it's real yields or, you know, nominal yield or this, that, you can make an argument why they're probably in a decent spot.
Yeah, well, and I think right around that same time that Rick was saying that, Jamie Dimon was out saying that he could see a 10-year at 7 or 8%, and everybody sort of freaked out. It seemed crazy at the time. We were still under 5, and then we got to 5 in August-ish of last year. Mortgage rates went to 8. Everybody freaked out again. And then I think what changed is that in October or so, we started to get a message that maybe it would be appropriate for the Fed to start lowering rates at some point in the next 12 months. And everybody took that as the Fed put is back. They will be here to save us. We now have the dry powder. Everything is fine. So carry on. I think there are two schools of thought or two things that are going on here. You've got basically an economy that's strong and a stock market that's been able to withstand higher rates. So that's part of the assumption and part of the enthusiasm that, okay, maybe we can absorb it and higher for longer is actually not an issue. And maybe valuations don't have to be much lower. And this is going to be okay. We're just trying to get used to it. In the stock market and the economy, that may be the case. What hasn't happened yet, or what we haven't seen the answer to yet, is whether or not we can withstand this from a borrowing perspective. And that's both on the corporate side, corporate borrowing, and consumer borrowing. If you look at, I mean, obviously we've beat the dead horse about credit cards and the rates that people are paying on credit cards. Perhaps that just hasn't taken hold yet and shown us delinquencies and charge-offs that have happened in a large way. But I think the bigger question is going to be whether or not smaller cap companies or companies that are mostly financed by debt can continue to roll over that financing. I don't think they can. The interest coverage ratios would have to be much less attractive than they are now if rates stay this high. We just haven't hit that point yet. And the feeling that we have right now, especially in the bond market, where you've got spreads so tight on both investment grade and high yield, that you've now got money managers and institutional investors searching for opportunity in the bond market in places that are much riskier than investment grade corporates. They're looking at EM debt, they're looking at convertibles, they're looking at a lot of different things just to grab that spread that might be available that is no longer available in the traditional ways.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a very astute listener, viewer named Marco emailed me a few days ago, and we had a back and forth. It was kind of interesting. And in what you just said about corporates being able to roll over at a sort of reasonable rate, right? A reasonable coverage. The whole idea that the Fed, you know, might be embracing this higher for longer, but they keep kind of talking dovishly, if you will. And wouldn't that actually be consistent with what they need to get done as it relates to the issuance of a lot of U.S. government debt, right? And the whole idea of what they spend to finance that debt, when we know that it's a both sides sort of issue politically, that we have this astronomical government debt, right? And they need to issue a bunch more, right? So I'm just curious, it's like maybe they're really threading the needle here with what corporate America needs, with what the U.S. government needs, and not breaking anything, if you will, especially where inflation is, and their focus on kind of keeping inflation at bay. And I don't mean like, you know, they don't have to slay it, I guess, you know what I mean? But as long as it stays, you know, in and around that 3% level, I've been saying this for a year and a half or so, why not just move it? Why just not move their target rate rather than deal with this 2% sort of thing, especially if we're having better than 2% GDP growth, which we have over the last year and a half or so?
Well, if they moved it now, we would be below target on a PCE basis, which I think would be really confusing for the market to take. And something that Guy and I have said for a while is that if they move the target, I think it actually sends the message that they don't have control anymore, that the tools that they have are not effective. And that's not a message that I think the market is going to want to hear either. So when you look at what's likely to happen with the Fed balance sheet as the year progresses, a lot of people have speculated, and I think correctly, because of Fed speak and because of just the way that the maturity spectrum looks on the balance sheet right now, that the Fed will let mortgages roll off or start engaging in outright sales of mortgage-backed securities from the balance sheet, but keep the level of the balance sheet about the same by now purchasing more short-term treasuries. So there is likely to be some, I don't want to use the word manipulation because I think that's probably too strong, but there is likely to be some twisty turny stuff going on in the yield curve because of the way that the Fed is going to maintain its exposure. They're just going to play with the maturity and the duration of the balance sheet exposure. But to your point, yes, they do have to keep issuing more debt because we've got a lot of stuff to cover and we're always up against the debt ceiling. So they have to issue more in order to just cover what we're doing in the economy. And we continue to say, when will it become a problem? When will our national debt be the issue? And it just doesn't occur.
Let's bring it back to the stock market for a second here. So we have the S&P 500 added 3% in March. It was up 10% on the year, one of the best quarterly starts of the year since 2019. We know what happened in 2019. To me, that was a bit of a ricochet, right? In 2018, the last quarter, we dropped 20% from its highs. So we got a bunch of that back in Q1 of 2019. What I find most interesting is that the NASDAQ, despite the concentration on this Mag 7, we've been talking about it again. And again, the S&P outperformed the NASDAQ in Q1. It was up 1.8% in March, and it was up 9% in the first quarter. That is not an occurrence we've seen too often, which brings us to this Mag 7, right? And the fact that we feel like, okay, we've lost Apple, which is down in the year. Tesla is down 30% in the year. Google has underperformed. So it really has been a story about NVIDIA, about Microsoft, about Meta, about Amazon, and the like. So talk to me a little bit, Liz. You know, a lot of folks would say this is really bullish, that you could lose an Apple, you could lose a Tesla, big components of the major indices, and still have this sort of outperformance in the S&P 500, which also tells you that other groups are participating more so than just the concentrated NASDAQ. Talk to us about that as we head into Q2, and really importantly, as we get into Q1 earnings and Q2 guidance in the next few weeks, because to me, I think this is going to be really important because most of those large mega cap, you know, if you will, tech stocks, they're actually meant to do a disproportionate amount of the earnings growth this year. And that's what's really important. So if they were to decelerate for any reason, and it seems like Apple and Tesla clearly are, then that would be a problem for the broad market.
Well, it seems like it would be, right? And coming off of last year, it felt like if we don't have the Mag 7, or even if we don't have one of the Mag 7, how are we going to keep this up? Yet we've kept it up. I'm looking at 1 month total returns in the S&P by sector. Best performing sector is energy, followed very closely by utilities over the last 1 month. That doesn't make a ton of sense considering all of the narrative around AI and all the enthusiasm that had occurred. So there's obviously a rotation that's still underway and that has a decent amount of legs, which is definitely healthy for the market. The third sector, third strongest sector, is materials. So now you've got energy and materials in the top three. That tells me that's more of an inflation thing. That's not necessarily something that we're looking at, okay, technology is going to change everything in 2024 again, or the economy is taking off again. I think that's an inflation story because inflation has stayed high and because we've got demand that is still strong. So maybe people had sort of tapped the brakes on demand or the idea of demand for a little while. Now you've got energy and materials up there. I think the Utes trade right now is more about dividends than it is about defense. And that will continue as long as we're sort of nearing rate cuts, but not quite there yet. And then if something starts to falter, you'll see consumer staples come back into the fold as well. And that becomes a defense trade. But right now, it seems like investors want things that are still cheaper that probably have upside, or they want dividends. And small caps continue to chug along, maybe not lead the pack, but chug along. And they haven't sent any signals that things are terribly wrong. So we continue to be in this place where there are sectors coming off the bench, there are industry groups coming off the bench, and the question remains, is it really fundamentally based, or is it just that money is clamoring for other places to go when it's so obviously overvalued in certain parts of tech and some of the high flyers?
Yeah, well, here's a little conundrum, right? And so we just kind of referenced that data that we saw, the PMI data out of China, okay? And so if you think that China now is kind of like turning a corner a little bit, right? And our economy was basically able to outperform pretty massively last year in 2023 without a whole heck of a lot of help from China. So if China manufacturing is starting to heat up a little bit here, and we're starting to see, let's say, maybe just global growth start to, you know, kind of pick up in general, won't this be really inflationary for a lot of those commodities that you just mentioned? And again, doesn't it make the Fed's job that much harder? Or is it just more of the same? Because again, you know, Fed Chair Powell, they pinned the US economy GDP growth in 2024 back in December at 1.4%. Now they basically suggest it could be 2.1%. That's basically been the average, you know, take out those COVID years, you know what I mean, and the prior 10 years to COVID or so. Might China finally be the thing that kind of adds to some of the excitement, you know what I mean, about the economy here, the soft landing that could turn into something else? But by the same token, you have the risk that inflation heats up in a lot of those industrial commodities, and then all of a sudden you have a situation where rates are going back higher. And I just wonder if that's something that we're going to be dealing with in the back half of 2024, because you mentioned this 2 weeks ago, the S&P has gone, you know, 280 some days without a down 2% day. When you have that sort of complacency, you do run the risk, right, for some sort of surprise where we price out a June cut, and then all of a sudden you start pricing in later 2024 hikes. That's something that I think should catch equity investors, you know, at least put a little fear in them.
I've said this a couple times in the last few weeks too. Usually you have something like a rug pull when everybody's positioned the other way. You've got positioning way off sides in a sense of everybody's now positioned for the soft landing. Everybody's positioned for the Fed can save it even if there is a 2% down day, or even if there is a protracted correction, it can't go past a certain point because the Fed will come in and save it. So the positioning is not only just sentiment bullish, but it's bullish from a cyclical perspective, it's bullish from a tech perspective, it's bullish from a rates perspective. And that's when you have the higher risk of somebody being, or something being able to come in and just pull the rug out from underneath the market, catch it totally off guard. We talk about the risks all the time. And even you, me, and Guy talk about the risks all the time. Chances are, all the risks that we talk about are not going to be the thing if there is a rug pull that do that. It'll be something else that we haven't talked about or that we haven't considered, or something that sets off, you know, a global currency crisis or whatever the case may be. There's no point, though, in trying to position for the Armageddon scenario until or unless there are signs for the Armageddon scenario. But you do have to be aware of the risk that there could be a complete turn of the corner just because everybody is complacent or positioned the wrong way. So the China thing, here's the thing about China. When we all reopened, we were counting on the Chinese consumer. We were counting on the Asian consumer, and then they didn't come in, and we were okay anyway. And then China started to pull back, and everybody got nervous about that. and we were okay anyway. So if China comes back online, because we're not depending on them to drive demand, we're not depending on them or even really factoring in commodity demand that would come out of China, I think it is a big risk to inflation, particularly on the commodity side. And remember, most commodities are denominated in dollars. So if the dollar continues to get stronger, you've got more expensive commodities around the globe. Some of that drives a risk of a spike in oil prices, which we've talked about a few times. If you've got a spike in oil prices, that puts a world of hurt on the inflation story everywhere. And the last thing I'll say is we got a summary of economic projections last week from the Fed, or a couple weeks ago from the Fed, looking at core PCE. So it's at 2.8 right now, the only expecting it to come down to 2.6 by the end of the year. That was a March projection. So that means over 9 months, we're not going down that much more in core PCE. And that's removing energy from the equation. So there's not even really an expectation that inflation is going to fall that much more this year. God forbid it goes back up and reheats. That's something that I think nobody's prepared for.
Well, it's interesting. You know, guy's been saying this, careful what you wish for. You know, when we had six cuts priced in, you know what I mean? If the Fed had to do that, it would probably be for a reason that you don't want to really happen. And this puts them in a very difficult situation. Let's just say in some way, shape or form, our economy has decoupled to some degree from China. And it could be the notion of reshoring and the like here. And then a whole host of the geopolitical issues we've all, you know, mentioned, you know, probably 100 times over the last year and a half or so, that, you know, the whole idea of reshoring is very inflationary, right? And so then if you have a situation where if China starts to inflect and there's demand for, you know, oil and industrial commodities, you know, that will be inflationary pressures on our multinationals and the like here. But at the same token, if the Fed were to ease policy here for some reason that is specific to the US, well, that will also stoke inflation again, right? So to me, the Armageddon scenario, you know, becomes, you know, you could explain it away and say, well, the Fed has so much dry powder here, you know what I mean, to kind of combat something. You know, a year ago when SVB was going under and there was a fear of contagion, well, the Fed got easy, right? At a time that they were also, you know, their monetary policy was fairly strict. You know what I mean? They were not showing any signs of laying off their rate hikes at the time, right? And so I don't know. It really does put them in a difficult situation.
With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. SoFi, the all-in-one super app for banking, borrowing, and investing. Earn industry-leading APY, get great loan rates, and trade stocks. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA SIPC.
Bringing it back to the stock market, I saw a headline this morning. Goldman takes S&P 500 valuations off the worry list. And so they're talking about the equal weight S&P valued at about 17 times earnings. I think this is interesting. When I think about the equal weight S&P, okay, I get it. You're kind of smoothing out, you know, NVIDIA's 300% gains and you're smoothing out, you know, Microsoft, a $3+ trillion market cap company, you know, now it's trading at 35 times or something like that. But what you're not doing is accounting for the fact that if those companies, okay, were to actually decelerate meaningful in NVIDIA, that will be the case, right? You will have, I think, a reversion to that kind of mean in a Microsoft very quickly. You will have 35 times go back to 29 times, even when you have an equal weight S&P at 17 and a market cap weight of 21. And the last point I'll just make, and why do I focus on the deceleration of earnings, is that at some point, that will happen, but those companies are a disproportionate amount of that high single digits earnings growth expected in this year. And if they can keep chugging along, then you will hit 9, 10% S&P 500 earnings growth. But once again, it will be focused on these names. And there's a no doubt, I think it's Loop Capital this morning, suggesting that Apple, okay, which is now a $2.6 trillion market cap company that was expected to grow earnings this year, let's call it 4-ish or so percent, could swing to a loss for the first time since 2016. So if you start seeing companies like that, or you have, you know, negative earnings growth out of, let's say, a Tesla, you know what I mean, which was an $800 billion market cap company that now is much less, you know what I mean? Like, that could really weigh on S&P 500 earnings, and thus will weigh on valuations, especially if it's top heavy.
So I was just doing some quick math as you were saying that. So if we, let's say we do see a reversion to the mean, even just in a PE level, if we're trading right now above 21 times PE, a 10-year average PE, forward PE in the S&P is 17.8 times, okay? So let's say earnings expectations don't move at all. Let's say they stay at $243 a share for 2024. You've got $243 a share times 17.8 PE. That puts the S&P at 4325. That is a far cry from where we are right now. And that, frankly, would be normal. And I think that's the rub here. A 17 point, that even sounds high to me, 17.8 times forward earnings. When you look at a lot of the corrections or the places where things would be the median, right, or a drawdown would take us to the median, you're talking about 15 to 16 times forward earnings. So even 17.8 still feels above that. That would bring the S&P down by 100 points from here. So I think what is probably likely to happen, it's, I don't know if it'll be a big tree shake, but I think there has to be some normalization of PEs, and it probably is largely driven by the ones that are overly inflated and that have more influence over the broad market PE. Will that scare people enough? I don't know the answer to that. For a long time, we thought that it would scare people to death if Apple went down. And now it turns out the market does okay even without Apple. So would it scare people a lot if NVIDIA went down? Probably. But is it enough right now after we've seen this big rotation into other sectors? I think that there is so much risk appetite still present in the equity market that people will continue to rotate unless proven otherwise, unless proven that something big is a real problem, and it just hasn't happened. So I think this risk appetite stays alive.
That's kind of my point, is that, you know, so the fact that the stock market is rallying without Apple is actually great. It's rallying without Tesla. The EV story has just, you know, downshifted kind of massively, right? It's the smartphone and the iPads and the PCs, not interesting. People want to know where the GPUs going in, what sort of supercomputers and data centers are being built out to power all these large language models, and what's going to be this massive inference phase. And, you know, I'm looking at a headline today from the Information, Microsoft and OpenAI plot $100 billion Stargate AI supercomputer. And they're basically suggesting that this sort of data center is like 100 times the cost of most data centers. I mean, these are the sorts of euphoric sort of headlines you see when everyone's all in on one sort of narrative. And so the fact that you've left out some of these other mega cap tech names and you've just wrapped it up, whether it's the PCs, whether it's the GPUs, whether it's the data centers, whether it's going to be, you know, the hyperscalers and the like, you know, all being able to benefit that, there's universal optimism about that right now. And I think that's priced in the market. But there's also an interesting article in the FT this morning. Huge AI funding leads to hype and grifting, warns DeepMind's Dennis Haspis. And so again, you know, there is some skepticism about this. It's not too different than some of the cycles that we saw in and around crypto. And obviously it was much smaller, you know what I mean, over the last 5 or 6 years or so. But this is technology, and this is the way investors think about it. And they ride these waves and they get to the companies that have these big moats, and then they think it's going to go on forever, and then it corrects. And so to me, what's dangerous about the fact that some point this year, I can promise you that NVIDIA is going to report a quarter that's less than what the street consensus is expecting, and they're going to guide below the, what the street is expecting for the next quarter. And then how investors react to that, what they choose to sell, their customers, there's huge customer concentration. It's Microsoft, it's Meta, it's Amazon, it's Google, you know. And so, and then you think about the public clouds that are obviously, you know what I mean, supporting all this activity. So you just goes on and on and on. Dell is at an all-time high. They're making a lot of the servers that go into these data centers. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So to me, ultimately, that's the story that could turn to the sort of negative feedback loop around one key narrative, you know what I mean? But you might have some of these other sectors doing just fine. If the financial sector is okay, well, then maybe the money centers keep chugging along, you know what I mean? Maybe the stuff exposed to the commodities and exposed to China, maybe they keep chugging along. So I don't know. That's just my two cents. But at some point, I think in 2024, we are going to have a 10 to 15% sell-off. Almost every year in the stock market, we have that. We had one last year when things seemed really rosy in July, right? And all the way down to late October, and then we just blow out and we rally 30%. So to me, I'm just curious, like let's go back to complacency, and let's go back to, if you're trying to call this out and say this is how it happens, you get labeled as somebody, well, eventually you'll be right, but it's likely to happen sooner than later, in my opinion, in the stock market here in the US.
Well, if you look at any theme, and as a strategist, I have to think long term as well and just asset allocation. But if you look at any theme, I would put crypto in this category. I'd put the internet in this category. There are many boom and bust cycles that occur when a theme is new and as it goes through its life cycle. So it doesn't mean that the theme booms and then busts and disappears as a theme, right? Crypto hasn't disappeared, but it has changed a lot from where people thought it would be, even back in 2020. What people thought would happen with crypto. It would take over all of the fiat currencies. We would be paying with crypto at the grocery store. We would get paid in crypto from our employer. And there are certainly pockets of that occurring, and there are certainly people and cohorts who are doing it that way, but it didn't sweep the world. It didn't sweep across the globe as quickly as everybody expected. And then there was a bust phase that occurred, and we lost some companies in that bust phase. Every theme goes through that as you find what I guess I would consider price discovery or some kind of enthusiasm discovery to make sure that we understand exactly what the utility is of that theme. And I will continue to say that about AI. I don't think AI is going anywhere. I don't think people are necessarily wrong about AI, but there are likely to be little booms and busts along the way. And there will be companies that are overly hurt by that or overly driven by that as we go through that life cycle. NVIDIA right now, I think, is at risk of being one of the ones that gets hurt by it because it has gone through such a boom, but it could last for a long time. So I don't know if you're right or not. Obviously, I can't talk about individual stocks. I don't know, you know, what'll happen with earnings, but I think there is a pretty big risk that we will go through some kind of mini bust just in the theme in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, listen, let's just be really clear. When it comes to NVIDIA, you know, the stock right now is up 82% on the year. It's a $2.3 trillion market cap company. Expected earnings growth this fiscal year is 90%, expected to go to 22% in fiscal 2026. And when you look at revenues, revenues are expected to be up 80-some percent this year, and again, to about 22%. So it's trading 37 times earnings this year, 21 times or sales next year, 30 times earnings and 17 times sales. So you're already pricing in meaningful deceleration. If that deceleration starts to look worse than expected for fiscal year 2026, so that's next year, okay, then the stock is going to start to look really expensive. And then just to kind of put a bow on the valuation conversation, because again, Goldman doesn't seem too worried about it. Just as this is per FactSet, that the forward 12-month PE ratio for the S&P 500 is about 21. It's above the five-year average of 19. It's above the 10-year average of about 18. So again, if you lose some of those biggest names, right, because their earnings start to decelerate and you rewrite, and you reprice them, many turns lower, you are going to have an S&P come back to the average over the 5 or 10 year period. And that's how you get much lower prices, because you just said if that 243 number ends up being high for 2024, that's $243 in earnings, and you go back to average multiples, right? You get a much lower S&P. So that's how you get that move lower, in my opinion. One last thing, Liz. Peter Buchvar, our good friend from Bleakley Advisors, and writes the book Report, and he's talking about this data, euphoric data from Citigroup. They track this sort of stuff and the percentile we're at. We'll put it in the show notes here. Are you starting to feel, among, let's call it the strategist class of folks, the pundit class of folks, this level of complacency around the enthusiasm, the euphoria of the market? You just said it yourself. There seems to be no end in sight to the risk, to the demand for risk taking, it seems right now. And that usually seems to me as something a bit dangerous, especially when there's so many unknowns, if you will. We have a VIX, just above 13 here. The move index that tracks treasury volatility, I mean, man, that thing just fell off the chart, lower right. So it just seems like that euphoria and the complacency seems very prevalent right now.
First of all, you want to know something scary, because you mentioned the long-term average PEs. If you look at actually the 10-year average, what do you think the 10-year average S&P level is?
Average S&P level, like the price level. Oof, it's got to be like 4,000, 4,100 or something like that.
2,959.
Holy, whoa.
Yeah. But that's over 10 years. That has a big drawdown in it, right? We've had some rough times. So I think further, and I am absolutely not saying that the S&P needs to get down to 2,959, but it does show you how much we've moved and how maybe abnormal some of the heights are, especially in a PE ratio. So back to, if we think about, what's going on in the bond market, and I think what's going on with treasuries, what's going on with all of these valuations and these moves, I do think that the euphoria and the positioning has gotten people to a point where we don't believe that it's possible for the market to go down in a big way again. And I don't think this is hard to say. I don't think that we're even at the point where it's that overly extended yet. I think it could go further. And I think it will go further if absent a big shock, absent some big negative news, because we still have all of the fundamentals in the background. You've got earnings growth that's been good. You've got economic growth that's been good. You've got a jobs market that is strong. You've got people that are still spending. Everything that we're being told is that everything is okay. And we're also being told that companies are okay, and that all this fear over margin compression didn't really occur, and that inflation took a bite, but people are still spending money, so everything must be fine. So I still think that this can go for a while. And I do think, as far as risk appetite goes, I don't think people are going to get scared easily. And I do think that we probably get to a point where it seems even more extended than it is now. But that is the scary part, right? And I think that I've mentioned this before, every big drawdown, every crisis, I'm not calling for a crisis, but every single one is preceded, unless by an exogenous shock, is preceded by excessive risk-taking in financial markets. I think we are at least on the cusp of seeing excessive risk-taking in financial markets in certain pockets. It probably has to get more widespread before it feels like a complete blanket of excessive risk-taking.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There was a couple IPOs a couple weeks ago, this Astera Labs, and again, some folks were thinking about it as like a kind of new issue, AI-related chip play, that doubled, right after its IPO. It's come in pretty significantly. Reddit, the story went from being this ad supported, social network, if you will, to being able to sell, data from their API, for training of large language models. And it's really high margin. And that was a story. And that thing doubled really quickly after its IPO in the week or two after, now since come off pretty hard. And so those are kind of interesting to see, at least as far as, how much scarcity value is actually in the markets and in the public markets when you have new issues come. So I keep an eye on those. You know, crypto is also one that to me seems very correlated with, just overlay that Bitcoin chart through the, you know, NVIDIA chart. Obviously, they don't have a lot to do with each other, but it does speak to what you were just mentioning about, you know, like risk appetite and people kind of pushed out of the curve here. But, you know, I just go back to the fact that you have Microsoft that's up 12% of the year. You have Amazon that's up nearly 20% of the year. You have Meta that's up 37% in the year. You have NVIDIA up 82% in the year. You know, Google's joining the party right now. It's making a new all-time high as we speak. This is obviously a cheap stock that's had poor execution in and around AI. And then Apple is the final one. Listen, if Apple were to do some deal as it was rumored, let's say with Gemini or OpenAI a couple weeks ago, and as we think about what they might roll out at their Worldwide Developers Forum on June 10th, if Apple were to join the AI party, to your point, Liz, this thing could go a lot further, just like it's been bullish. We started this conversation out where lots of investors think it's bullish that we're able to make new highs almost every day. Was it 20 new highs this year or something plus without Apple, without Tesla? You know, Tesla's got an AI story, whether you like it or not. I mean, that's the thing that kind of is driving this full self-driving theme. And we know that Elon Musk is very focused on this space. So if those two were to join this party, things could get a little exciting, I guess you will, to the upside.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at, as you're saying this, I'm looking at another all-time high that's being made in gold today, which that's not bullish.
And yeah, all right. Wait, all right, break that down. Okay, because this is really important. I think a lot of folks, you know, I'm by far a gold bug, okay? But a lot of people think it's inversely correlated, right, to stocks in general, right? Inversely correlated to the dollar. So the dollar's had a big run here. Why is gold moving the way it is? Why has, you know, Bitcoin, after it's made this huge move over the last 2 months, been able to just sit here after a lot of volatility over the last year and a half? Those things seem to be, you know, at least in some sort of debate with the notion that you're willing to pay any price for some AI-related stock in the public or private markets.
Right. Okay. So gold, there's what I would call short-term trading in gold, and then there's long-term cyclicality in gold. If you believe the long-term cyclical story, you would expect gold to slowly rise over this period. If you've got demand, if you've got commodities going up, and you've got a cyclical expansion going on around the globe, you would expect that. You would not expect it to spike up the way that it has. I'm looking at a chart of it. If you even just look at from mid-February until now, gold is up from, it was 2006, now it's at 2247. That is a spike in gold prices. Now, there are a couple different reasons people might buy gold. You might buy gold just out of straight fear. I don't think that's the case right now. There isn't really fear baked into any other part of the market. So I don't think it's people hunkering down, buying gold and, you know, putting bullion in the basement kind of thing. But there is the expectation that the Fed will eventually lower rates. Now, gold doesn't pay a dividend. You don't get a yield off of gold. It's a non-yielding asset. So it could follow the dividend trade where you've got rates coming down, you're not getting the opportunity for yield in some of those treasury securities and money markets, you name it. So then yield doesn't become as much of the buying factor. You've got gold as an appreciation of a cyclical expansion. Also, I think that there is a strong correlation right now. I think this is most of what's going on. Strong correlation right now between what's happening in gold and fear over global currency moves. And you've got a lot of what's happened in the yen. I wrote about it last week. We continue to talk about the yen and the big movements in the yen, and not just the yen versus the dollar, but the yen versus all of the major currencies around the globe. And the fact that central banks, global central banks, are now starting to move in different directions. So you've got the Bank of Japan starting a rate hiking cycle. You've got the Fed at some point embarking on a rate cutting cycle. You've got the Bank of Switzerland doing something different. So all of these central banks now are running policy according to what's happening in their country, which is exactly what they should do. But it is confusing to currency markets. It is confusing to things like gold and Bitcoin and the dollar, because we don't know which direction all of them are supposed to move if everybody's moving in different ways. So I think that gold is sending a signal that people are concerned that something could end up pulling a rug out, and that it's more related to currency than anything else at this point.
Yeah, and that's a really great point. And Guy and I have chatted about this a little bit. And the fact that you're basically saying it's related to currency fears. And again, with all these central banks, like with different inclinations about which direction they're going to go, the BOJ coming off the mat after, you know, nearly two decades in the like, or however long it's been, is definitely really interesting. If you think about the move, let's say that gold has had, to your point, up 13% or so in just about 2 months. And you think of that in market cap terms, that's over $1 trillion. It's probably like $1.5 trillion. And then if you think about Bitcoin basically doubling in 3 months or so, and now has basically the market cap of what gold just gained over that time period, it tells you that the techies, the people who like the nerd gold, they're doing it for speculative reasons, in my opinion. The people or the institutions that are buying the gold are doing it for a whole host of different reasons, and they are at contrast with each other. So I think that's a really great point you make. All right, Liz, we covered a lot of ground. We have the all-important jobs report on Friday. Do you expect some volatility in the markets? Let's say Friday morning, we get a really hot jobs number, and that basically pushes the June rate cut out. Is that something that will be, you know, welcomed by investors in the stock market, or is it something that will be feared, and vice versa? You know, is a weak number cheered, I guess, by, you know, investors, basically saying that keeping that June, the probability over, let's cut it, 50% of a cut in June, is that something that would be cheered? I don't know.
I think at some point, if we keep pushing rate cuts out, the market will stop liking it. And I don't know if that's going to be this week. I think as investors, as a whole, we're practicing a lot of confirmation bias and a lot of just, we'll figure out a way to make the news positive. So even if it is a weaker jobs report, I think people will try to make it a positive in the sense of, well, that means we'll still get cuts. And yes, we needed it to cool a little bit. If it's stronger, the narrative will continue to be, well, you know, everybody's got a job. That's good for the economy. At some point, the market will stop liking pushing rate cuts out further and further and further. And I still say, I mean, it sounded crazy a couple months ago. Keep your eye on September, November, because if we make it to November, that is the longest pause we've ever had. If they don't cut rates until November, longest Fed pause ever. We're already in the longest yield curve inversion ever. This could be, and my outlook for 2024 was titled A Cycle for the Ages. This could literally turn out to be the longest cycle in every single metric that we usually look at. And we are right on the doorstep of getting to all of those. And Guy, if Guy were here, he would tell you the longer it goes, the harder it is on the other side. That may be the case. And I don't think that it's something that we should ignore, that we are extending and protracting the cycle much longer than we've ever really been used to.
Well, listen, you guys say the other side. As long as I can think about this, 2008 was a pretty bad, you know, I guess market crash, if you will. But there was 1 year that the stock market sold off. That was 2008. So it wasn't down in 07 and it wasn't down in 09. And you have to go all the way back, you know, to the post.com, you know, bubble bursting and just so much excess coming out of the NASDAQ. And even then the S&P was only down 56 or five, you know, something like that, percent or so. And yes, we did have three consecutive down years, but during COVID, we didn't even have a down year. I mean, think about that, right? So, you know, maybe the Fed and the institutions have gotten better at it, but who knows? We do have this huge sovereign debt bubble. That seems to be the thing that a lot of folks are just willing to kind of kick the can down the road about, at least the corporate cycles. I think that's what you're talking about here, have been massaged away, and recessions have been massaged away. So there you have it, people. All right, Liz, thank you so much for being here early on a Monday morning. You'll be back with Guy and me on Wednesday on the market call. If you haven't already, check out a conversation that Guy and I had with David Rosenberg of Rosenberg Research. That was on the Tape podcast feed. It dropped on Friday morning. We pushed back on Rosie a great deal about what we all, you know, are fairly bearish about, whether it be the economy, the markets. We kind of had to do a little bit of a straw man here. I think it was a really good conversation. So check that out. Liz, thank you. We'll see you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, FactSet, and SoFi. If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com. Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.